Yes, he has a break.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for coming out tonight, or this afternoon, rather. Such a beautiful Sunday afternoon, and after such a long, snowy winter. Father, you wouldn't understand being in L.A., but it's been a long winter, so I appreciate everyone coming in, and of course, you've made the better choice, right, to be here with Father. We heard Father was out giving a conference, and we couldn't resist putting him to work on a Sunday afternoon, so when we found he was available, we were delighted. Father Spitzer, Jesuit, is president of the Maggi Center of Reason and Faith, and he's the former president of Gonzaga University in Seattle, and the founder of the Philosophical Foundations of Physics Institute at Georgetown University. He's an educator, a philosopher of science, which is very interesting, metaphysicist, theologian, and author. Father Spitzer lectures around the world on the intersection of faith, science, and reason, which, you know, is so important today, especially with young people. And I think sometimes they feel they have to make a choice between their faith in Christ and in God and scientific facts, right? So Father is on the forefront of that work, a very important work of catechesis and faith and knowledge about creation. The 2012 Pew Survey of Religion and Public Life indicates that the percentage of young millennials, and those are those born between 1990 and 1994, aren't they in pre-K? No. Declaring themselves nuns, that means they have no religious affiliation or no belief in God, is 34%. So a third. That is the future, right? Unless we do something. While the general population sits around 20% that have no affiliation. The Maggi Center was founded to counter the negative impact that secular myths are having on our youth. So very important work, very urgently needed. And Father, hopefully you'll be able to mention a few things about your good work with the Maggi Center. And I know we've got some of the materials, too, that we're going to be using here. The mission of the Maggi Center is to explore and share the close connection between reason and faith, as revealed by new discoveries in science, philosophy, and the historical study of the New Testament. It focuses on 10 life-transforming truths and 4 popular secular myths that undermine them. These secular myths are 1, the false conflict between faith and science, 2, the false conflict between suffering and the love of God, 3, the false conflict between virtue and freedom, and 4, the false conflict between the historical Jesus and the Jesus of the Gospels. Today at St. Veronica, Father Spitzer will address the false conflict between suffering and a loving God. So please welcome Father Spitzer.
I will be addressing that conflict. Father Hathaway just pointed out, it's an interesting conflict, really. It sits amidst all these other ones. And if we don't do something about it, we just will continue to have a movement of our young people toward a greater and greater agnosticism in the future. This particular conflict between suffering and the love of God goes like this. Why would an all-powerful, all-loving God allow suffering in the world? After all, if he were all-powerful, he could prevent suffering. And if he were all-loving, he would prevent it. That seems to be logical at first. It seems to be correct. But in point of fact, of course, it's a real problem that vexes our kids and is completely false. Suffering and love are not incompatible with one another. In fact, a great deal of love can come from suffering and not just vice versa. Yes, suffering can lead away from love, but it can also lead towards it. It can also be chastening. It can also be humbling. It can also create compassion. It can also create virtue. It can also create self-definition. Suffering need not have a merely negative effect. It can be incredibly positive if we interpret it correctly, if our young people know how to suffer well, and if, in some sense, we can see how God can operate through it with freedom. When we've been dealing with this problem at the Montessori Institute, what we've been doing is working on a 5-step program to kind of help the students to move from one side to the next, from a side of seeing suffering merely as a negative to actually treating it with positivity, and also with using God's grace to help them to get those positives out of suffering. So I'll just, maybe give you the 5 steps that we use, and then, try to proceed to unpack them for you, hopefully not slowly but surely, but hopefully quickly as I can, so that we can actually get to the matter at hand. But step number one, if we're going to help students to move through suffering, they have to have what we're going to call a higher level view of happiness. It's not going to be good enough to have what we're going to call level 1 or level 2 view of happiness. They will have to eventually move to level 3 and level 4. The second thing that's truly important is we have to give the students a sense of their own transcendence. A lot of students are willing to reduce themselves to atoms and molecules, to merely a biological entity that has no eternity in God, that has no dignity that rests on that eternal destiny, that has not a dignity that's transcendent, but a merely immanent or materialistic dignity that just, kind of reduces themselves either to a biological mechanism or to a machine. If you take a poll of students, you will find the vast majority of them are uncertain about whether they have a soul, uncertain about whether they're transcendent, very certain that they are biological and that they are mechanical. And so it's very easy for them to slip out of a notion of an eternal destiny, an unconditionally loving destiny, and a transcendent destiny to a merely materialistic one. And so that's a big problem. And so we have to help students to move beyond it. We've been using near-death experiences as the main way of doing that because it works, it's incisive, there are excellent peer-reviewed medical studies of these things, the cases range in the thousands, and so it's really a great approach to helping the students move in that direction. There's a third step, though, that needs to be taken care of before we can deal with, how to suffer well. And that third step is, what about Jesus? What about God? Is God a loving God? Because if students are suffering, the first thing they think of is either that God is not loving or God doesn't exist if they don't have a really strong foundation from their school or from their parents. Essentially, they wind up moving away from the love of God, and there has to be a way of communicating to them what and who God is. So our objective is to help the students to move away from what we're going to call the payback God, the stoic God, the get-even God, the God who's disgusted with you, and all the kinds of gods that come into the back of your mind when you're growing up in your childhood, in your adolescence, and they do creep in, and also when you're suffering, the kinds of gods that kind of come into your mind as being the kinds of gods that are really real versus the loving God. If we can do these three things, then we can take on the real question. Why would an all-loving God allow suffering? We divide the question into two parts. Why would an all-loving God allow human beings to cause suffering to other human beings? And also, why would an all-loving God allow the blind forces of nature, say earthquakes or diseases or floods, to cause suffering to other human beings? And there are two different answers to those questions. So you really do have to divide the question in two parts. But they're very good answers to those questions. And we're going to do that after the break. And then the 5th step. We have to teach our students how to suffer well. We have to tell them, we have a three-step process that we give to the students. You can supplement it with a fourth step, you know, if you want to, if there's time. But the three steps we consider essential, we'll talk about, after we talk about why an all-loving God would allow suffering. It's going to be absolutely crucial that the students learn these things. Because if they don't, they won't have the tools to suffer well. If they don't suffer well, suffering becomes such a negative instead of such a potentially positive. So that's the challenge that lies before us. Needless to say, we live in a culture that has a very low threshold for suffering. And we're not living in a developing culture. We're not living in the pre-World War II world, where the threshold for suffering was 5, 6, 7 times higher. Where in those other developing countries, the threshold for suffering, 5, 6, 7 times higher. We have a very low threshold for suffering in this culture. So it makes it all the more imperative to help the students with this low threshold. That's what they've been given. That's what they've inherited, right? It makes it all more imperative that we get this done and do it for them expeditiously. Well, that's the method to our madness at the Mudge Center. I mean, obviously we do the faith and science questions. And by the way, during the Q&A after the break, I'm happy to take science. You know, if you want to ask me why there has to be a creator outside of universal space-time asymmetry, I'd be happy to answer that question. So, but for the time being, let's stick with the question at hand. And go through our five-step process, if just a bit too briefly. With the students, we would take this on, you know, we have a five-part video series called, you know, Happiness. And then we would take on these five questions, one videotape per question. So this is going to be a very punctuated and abbreviated way of doing it. Let's start with the first question about happiness. Many of you have probably heard me talk about the four levels of happiness before, but with respect to the question on suffering, this is an imperative thing. I'll just repeat our thesis at the Mudge Center. If you don't get students up to level 3 and level 4 happiness, suffering will be altogether unintelligible. They will not know why. By the way, this is not just students. This is adults. This is older citizens. Right? Who are the people who request euthanasia? I can tell you who the active euthanasia, like physician-assisted suicide, right? They're the people who are basically on level 1, level 2 dominant happiness. If you get to level 3 and level 4, if we do our job right in Christian education, Catholic education, then we can help them. They're not going to request suicide. They're not going to request lethal injection. They're not going to do it. So it's not just students. It's across the board. Suffering and learning how to deal with suffering, it's imperative what our view of happiness is. Now, why this word happiness, you might ask yourself? I mean, what's the point? I mean, why does this word affect everything? Because it actually affects why we're living, what we consider to be our purpose in life. It actually affects who we think we are. Whether we think we're moving somewhere or then we're not moving somewhere. Our life is worth something, our life is not worth something. It's all dependent upon one little word. The great philosopher Aristotle, in a classic work, exceedingly important work, probably one of the most important works of ethics in Western civilization beyond the Bible, is called the Nicomachean Ethics. And in that book 1, chapter 1, right in the very beginning of that book, this is what Aristotle essentially says. Happiness is the one thing you can choose in and for itself. Everything else is chosen for the sake of happiness. Let me repeat that. Happiness is the one thing you can choose in and for itself. That's what you want, right? If you tell me, I really don't want happiness, I know. You're a masochist. I know. You probably have clinical depression. It's okay. But it's not normal. Normal people want to be happy. That's why Aristotle says it's the one thing you can choose in and for itself. And everything else, I choose it for the sake. I choose my spouse because I think she or he will make me happy. Right? Not my spouse. I choose my friends because I think they'll make me happy. I choose my career because I think it'll make me happy. All of these things somehow, right? We've got a definition of happiness rolling around in the backs of our minds. And we're trying to get that definition satisfied. We're trying to get that defined notion of happiness satisfied. In our every waking hour, we are trying. And that's why this term, Plato and Aristotle devoted the academy to defining the word happiness. That's how important the ancient Greeks thought this word was. So let's get to it. If we just had four levels of happiness, I'm just going to go through the levels with you very, very quickly, incisively here. And then I'm going to talk about a real tension point between level one and two on the one hand and level three and four on the other. But level one happiness, let's just call it pleasure material happiness. Pleasure material. It comes from an external source to us, right? So it's the kind of happiness that comes from the outside. Bob Spitzer sees the bowl of linguine with the extra garlic, lunges toward it, wolfs it down, goes yum, and he's happy. He's happy. There's nothing else required, right? Bob Spitzer sees the huge slab of roast beef done, right? Rare to medium rare. You get the point. Bob Spitzer rides in the Mercedes 500 E-Class with leather upholstery, just feeling the German engineering going around the curve. And he's happy. He's happy. Nothing else required. Notice that this kind of happiness, right? Notice the following. Number one, it's instantly gratifying. So you don't, no delayed gratification. Get it right away. Number two, notice its other advantage. It's very intense. It rivets me to itself. Each noodle of linguine with the sauce going down. Just riveting. Thirdly, notice that it's surface apparent. Children can do it as well as adults. You don't need any education. The smell of the linguine is good enough. Hearing the purr of a German engine is good enough. You get the point. It's surface apparent. No study, no nuance, no education. Easy. Level one. Wow. Just think of the advantages. There is, however, a slight problem. Level one is not pervasive, enduring, and deep. It doesn't go very far beyond myself. Even the fifth bowl of linguine affects very few beyond me and my stomach. Number two, it doesn't last very long. You have one bowl of linguine, a half hour later, you'd like another bowl. Number three, it's not deep. It uses none of our highest psychological creative powers. Doesn't use our intelligence, doesn't use our education, doesn't use our capacity to do moral reasoning, doesn't use our spiritual capacity, doesn't use our ideals and our choices to make the world a better place, doesn't use our creativity for art or music or anything else. It simply doesn't use anything of depth or consequence, any of the powers that enable us to do something for the world. It's just dead on the level of pervasive, enduring, and deep. But it is instantly gratifying. It is intense. And it is surface apparent. So it's hard to give up. But nevertheless, we know we have to do some of that. I can't eat linguine 24/7. Can't just ride around in the Mercedes. Enough said. Level two. We'll call level two ego comparative happiness. That's the kind of happiness that comes from having a comparative advantage over others. And by the way, all these kinds of happiness are good. All of them are good, right? You have to have them all. There's a good side to all of them. So ego comparative happiness can come from achievement, status, anything which we can compare, popularity, intelligence, power, control, winning. You get the point. Who's achieving more? Who's achieving less? Who's more popular? Who's less popular? Who's winning? Who's losing? Who's smarter? Who's not so smart? You get the who's perceived to be smarter? Who's perceived to be not so smart? You get the point. So we're constantly asking these questions, but as we'll see in just a moment, there is some difficulty with level one and level two becoming dominant. Let's just summarize by saying jealousy, emptiness, fear of failure, fear of loss of esteem, ego sensitivities, inferiority, superiority, and while you're at it, ego rage, ego blame, self-pity, and all of the other things that make life so wonderful. There's a problem. There's definitely a problem. If you let level two get out of control and become what we're going to call identity dominant. So it's actually going to become the most important kind of happiness. The most important kind of happiness becomes your purpose in life, right? And this can happen without you choosing it. It can just happen to you slowly but surely, surreptitiously. You live for it and live for it. And the next thing you know, gotcha! You're it. You become it. So, obviously, is achievement good? I would like every Gonzaga student. I used to be the president of Gonzaga, right? I want every Gonzaga student to be really high achieving. So there's nothing wrong with achievement. Intelligence, nothing wrong with that. I've tried to cultivate my, a brain for a few years. You know, nothing wrong with that. I want every Gonzaga student to be intelligent. I'd like every Gonzaga student to have status and popularity. Hey, without status and popularity, you're not going to have any credibility. No credibility, you're not going to be able to do anything because no one will listen to you. They must give you credibility for. So all these things are good things. You got to have some sense of winning and so forth. Otherwise, you just let your competitors roll right over you. So these things are good. But boy, when they get out of control, they're killers. And they're killing our kids too, by the way. And they're a big, huge reason for unhappiness. A huge reason. Right? You want to see why kids commit suicide? You want to see why they go into depression? You want to see why they get into unquenchable depression? Go to level two. Bet you about 70% of the time, source of it is right there. Not traumas, not chemical imbalances. It's right there. Some kind of crazy comparison going on. Number three. There's a third kind of happiness, third level of happiness. And that's the kind of happiness that comes from making a positive difference to somebody or something beyond myself. Every single one of us is hardwired to want to make a difference with our life. We really do want the world around us to be better off for our having lived. No one can stand to think that the world's not better off for their having lived. That causes incipient despair. I mean, if you get to 80 years old and you say, what was the difference between the value of my life and that of a rock? And you had to say, well, nothing. Maybe the rock did more for humanity than me. You would obviously be not just in incipient despair, be on the brink of full-blown despair. My life is meaningless. We don't want that. In fact, we're hardwired for the opposite. Instead of avoiding meaninglessness, we actually go on the quest for meaning. We want to make an optimal positive difference to our family, optimal positive difference to our friends, optimal positive difference to our organizations or institutions, optimal positive difference for our communities, or maybe for a developing country, optimal positive difference for the church or the kingdom of God, an optimal positive difference for the culture or for society if we're so lucky. We want to make an optimal positive. We want our lives to have an optimal value. We do not want to pass away from this world thinking we did nothing. We couldn't stand it. That's level three, contributive. Let's call it contributive happiness. And by the way, when we do make a difference to our family or to our friends or to our organization or to the culture, to the church or the kingdom of God or whatever it may be, it does make us happy. Feels different from an ego high, level two. Feels different from a linguine high, level one. But for all intents and purposes, it makes us happy. Number four. We are also ultimatizers. We're transcendent beings. We're transcendental beings. More on that in just a moment. What do I mean by a transcendental being? We desire perfect and unconditional truth, love, goodness, beauty, and home. We do. We really do want the complete set of correct answers to the complete set of questions. At least we did before we got jaded. I mean, my little nieces, they used to run up to me and go, "Uncle Bobby, well, why is this?" "Oh, because of this." "Well, why is that?" "Oh, because of that." "Well, why is that?" Finally, you have to go time out because you're in the deepest modes of quantum physics, right? But they're like little exocet missiles. They just keep coming relentlessly because they know something. You have not given them the complete set of correct answers to the complete set of questions. You have not told them everything about everything. And what they really desire to know is everything about everything. That's what they really want. And I didn't give it to them. You can be sure another question is coming. The point is clear. We do want to know everything about everything. We want perfect knowledge, perfect understanding, perfect truth. Oh, by the way, we want perfect love too. Perfect and unconditional love, that's what's required. I remember once I was teaching over at Georgetown, across the river there. And I was teaching up at Georgetown, and one of my physics students came up to me, went out on a retreat with me. And, you know, I was trying to prove to him at one point, he had asked me, he said, "You know, honestly," he says, "if general relativistic considerations proceed back to a Friedman model singularity, I have no difficulty with believing in a causative force outside of universal space-time asymmetry," which means he believed in God for physical reasons. So I said, "Well, what's your problem? You believe in a creator, what's your problem?" He goes, "It's the Jesus thing." He said, "I don't get it." And so I was trying to explain it to him. And I was kind of using these six questions to get him to move from just a creator or a powerful God to Jesus, who was an unconditionally loving God. So I kind of started off and trying to move him step by step to get there. Let's call him Steve. His name was Steve, as a matter of fact. I said, "Hey, Steve, you know what? What's your most important power? I mean, what's the one that makes the most difference in your life? The one that's so positive, right, that it cannot go awry. It always orients itself to what is positive and what is good. It cannot fail." So he's thinking about this, you know, he goes, "Well, I know it's not my creativity, because I could really use that for evil." I said, "Okay, let's get rid of creativity. Well, what next?" He says, "I know it's not my intelligence. I could use that for evil too." "Okay, something positive, something negative." Okay, let's get rid of that. So he's kind of going through the list, and finally he looks up at me and goes, "Well, is it love?" And I said, "Well, what do you think?" He said, "Well, I think love probably goes, if it's really authentic love, I mean, I think it should always orient towards something positive. It should always be my most powerful a capacity, because after all, you know, it creates relationships, and you know, we're stronger together than individually, and so forth." So he said, "Well, is it love?" I said, "Well, I think it is." So I said, "Hey, Steve, let me ask you a second question." He goes, "Well, what's that?" I said, "Do you think the creator that you just admitted to outside of universal space-time asymmetry, do you think that transcendent creator would be devoid of love if that is the most powerful capacity you have, and if that's the most positive entity there is in the universe? Do you think that the transcendent creator could be devoid of love?" And he said, "No." I said, "Okay, great. So let's go to a third question. Hey, do you want love, some love, or do you really want unconditional love?" Do you really want perfect love? And he goes, oh, this one I can tell you for sure. I've never wanted unconditional love. I'm too realistic for that. I said, okay. So you never had a girlfriend, right? And you began to see these flaws in her. She wasn't perfectly understanding, perfectly responsive, a perfect home for you, perfectly capable of doing all these various things. And then she'd get stressed out. And then she'd get, right, she'd react to you adversely and so forth and so on. So, I'm going through this thing. And I said, and finally, you just get disgusted with her. She just gets tired and stressed and does finite things. And she can never get it right. She doesn't understand me perfectly. She's not perfect meaning in life for me. She's not perfect home. I give up. She's not the one. And then you just rejected her. And he goes, yeah, I did that a couple months ago. I said, well, Steve, what are you looking? What were you looking for? And he goes, perfect love? I said, I'd say so, And you were trying to extract it from this poor, finite human being who couldn't possibly meet your expectation because the only one who could is God. And he goes, oh. I said, well, I got another question for you. He goes, okay. I said, well, do you think the creator you just admitted to, do you think that creator, do you think he'd be devoid of unconditional love if that's the only thing that will really satisfy you? And he goes, well, maybe not. I said, okay. Fifth question. If God really is, in some sense, unconditional love, if he at least couldn't be devoid of it, then would it be the case that unconditionally loving God, would it be just typical of an unconditionally loving God to want to come down here to this earth to be with you face to face, peer to peer, out of sheer empathy and love for you? Would an unconditionally loving God want to be Emmanuel? Would he want to be with you? God with us. And he looked at me and he said this one phrase, I get the Jesus thing. That's what he said. Exactly. But it all hinges on seeing something within ourselves, that what we're really looking for is unconditional love. My nieces are not just looking for unconditional truth. They're looking for unconditional love. They're looking, too, for unconditional fairness or justice or goodness. I'm telling you, right? You remember when a kid hits about, 9 years old and figures out that their parents are not perfectly just or fair? They've got them dead to rights in an act of unfairness. And then the lower lip extends quiveringly and just says, in complete outrage as the world has tipped over, that's not fair. They've been betrayed. You remember? Just 9, 10, 8, right in that region, figure it out. Did you teach your children what perfect fairness was so that could be used as a criterion against you? No. But they knew it. They knew it. What were they looking for? How did they know it? Back to that in a moment. We want to point out to kids is you want it too. And you're very strange because you do. Number four, you want perfect beauty. Let me tell you, everybody wants perfect beauty. You watch a teenager turn that music up until it is 5,000 decibels blowing into their ears. And you say, why are you doing that to yourself? It's more beautiful this way. You're going on a hike. You've just seen the most beautiful view in the world. And in hopeful anticipation, if I just make this curve, I'll see even something even more beautiful. That church, I've seen it a dozen times. It's boring to me now. More than the Stephan's Dome, beyond Notre Dame, I need more. Yeah, we want perfect beauty. Oh, yeah, we do. We're not satisfied with any partial state of beauty. Hold with me for just a moment. And we want perfect home, too. You know, we don't want an imperfect home because we feel emptiness and alienation when we are not at home into a perfect home, which I'll describe in a moment. The key thing that Plato noticed 2,400 years ago, a pagan, is that we want perfect and unconditional truth, love, goodness, beauty, and home. And boy, there's something weird about that. Do you recognize that you can recognize every imperfect truth? Just like my nieces could when I wasn't giving them the knowledge of everything about everything. They recognize it. You recognize it. Do you realize that you can recognize every imperfection in love in other people and in yourself? You can. All you have to do is utilize that power within you. You can see imperfection in love. In fact, it strikes you. By the way, do you realize that you and your children can recognize every imperfection in justice or fairness? You don't even have to try. When the injustice comes down the corridor, you know. Even if you're the perpetrator, you know. And beauty, we recognize every imperfection in beauty. We want more. We recognize every imperfection in home because we feel alienated and out of kilter in the whole cosmos and empty when we don't have it. We know. We know. Now, the interesting thing, said Plato, is how would you be able to recognize every imperfection in truth, love, goodness, beauty, and home unless you had some idea of what perfect and unconditional truth, love, justice or goodness, beauty, and home is? How could you possibly recognize every imperfection unless you had some sense, some awareness of what perfect truth would be like, what perfect love would be like, what perfect justice or goodness would be like? How could you do it? And let me ask you the final question. If you really do have an awareness of what perfect truth would be like, and perfect love would be like, and perfect justice or goodness would be like, perfect beauty would be like, and perfect human home would be like, where did you get that from? I can tell you one thing right now, you didn't get it from the world. There's not one perfect truth out there. Anybody, even, you know, give me the tensor, right? One of the highest mathematical expressions can encompass the whole of general relativity physics. Is that perfect truth? No. And you know it, right? Is the general theory, is the quantum theory, is the integration of quantum theory and general theory of relativity, is that going to be perfect? No, and you know it. You know it. I'm just asking, did you get your awareness of perfect truth from the world? Did you get it from your brain? You think you got it from brain circuitry? You did not. Your brain circuitry, I admit, is very complex and beautiful and wonderful and does all kinds of magnificent things, but it's all premised on algorithmically finite structures. Every one of them, imperfect to the hilt. Where'd you get it? That's all I'm asking. I'll give you one clue. I'll give you Plato's answer. You got it from perfect truth itself. You got it from perfect intelligibility itself. You got it from perfect knowledge itself. A perfect mentative act. A perfect act of thinking. Where did you get your notion of perfect love? Go ahead. Look around the entire world. Is there perfect love out there? Something you could recognize and then compare it to all the imperfect kinds of love? Nope. You just knew it inside yourself. Oh, did you get it from your brain circuitry? Nope. You know, very highly conditioned and imperfect. Beautiful, nice, elegant, wonderful, but still not perfect. Where did you get your idea of perfect justice from? If not justice itself, if not goodness itself, if not love itself, if not truth itself, if not beauty itself, if not home or being itself, where did you get it? I'm just asking. And if you did get it from perfect truth, love, goodness, beauty, and being, you know what that means? If perfect truth, love, goodness, beauty, and being is God, if that's what God is, then God is present to your consciousness 24/7. creating, as it were, the backdrop over against which you can recognize every imperfect dimension of truth, every imperfect aspect of love, every imperfect aspect of justice or goodness. God is present to you, creating your creative drive to move beyond the imperfection, to ask the next question, to get to the next level of authentic love, to get to the next level of fairness or justice. Have we ever wondered for a second why, out of all the terrible wars we've had, we come to civil rights, we come to individual rights, we come to economic rights, we come to all kinds of things which are incredibly important, progressive manifestations of human justice in the world that has prevented the next level of war? There's something about us, I'm telling you, God present to us 24/7. That's all I want the kids to see. And if that's the case, then Augustine is right. Remember what he says at the very beginning of the Confessions? He says, "For thou hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee." For thou hast made us for perfect and unconditional truth, love, goodness, beauty, and being. And our hearts will be restless until we get perfect and unconditional truth, love, goodness, beauty, and being. Nothing else will satisfy us. We will be restless hearts. And if that's the case, then you are transcendental entities. You got a soul capable of actually perceiving the presence of God, the presence of perfect truth, love, goodness, beauty, and being, and acting on it. If you think you're just a bunch of molecules, think again, you little ultimatizers, you. You little transcendental creatures, you. The point is clear. There's something more to live for. Now, all we want is for our kids to see this, so that when they do see it, they see the whole menu. There are four things. They're all good. Every last one of them. Material things are good. Hey, nothing wrong with an Arturo Fuente cigar, a glass of single malt scotch, and a bowl of perfect linguine. Nothing wrong with this. Nothing. Could kill you early, but, you know. Number two, there's nothing wrong with esteem and credibility, right? Self-esteem and credibility and competitiveness and intelligence and cultivated intelligence through education. There's nothing wrong with this. There's nothing wrong with high achievement, etc. All these things are good. There's nothing wrong with being contributive, of being loving. There's nothing wrong with that. And there's nothing wrong with the transit. They're all good things. They're good things. But here is the rub. The rub is, if we make level 1 and 2 dominant, if that becomes the most important thing to us in our lives, then slowly but surely the questions regarding levels 1 and 2, they begin to take over our whole sense of purpose or meaning in life. Who's achieving more, who's achieving less, becomes all important. Who's got more power, who's got less power, all important. Who's got more status, who's got less status. Who's more popular, who's less popular, all important. All of a sudden, these things then take on such significance. They become so self-definitional. We forget that we're transcendent beings called to live in the midst of God, called to seek out perfect truth. We forget that we're contributive and loving beings, called to do the optimal positive good for family and friends and church and kingdom of God, community and culture and society. We forget totally our higher nature. We are sitting there wondering, hey, if I don't belong to the Mensa Society, does this mean I should jump off a cliff because I'm an idiot? Is that what I'm supposed to do? Because it's all important, you know. Tells you very important. And of course, and who's stronger? Who's less strong? Who's more beautiful? Who's less beautiful? Blah, 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 blah. Every comparative characteristic takes on such an exaggerated importance, it goes right into the forefront of my mind. And here's what happens to the kids. Here's exactly what happens to them. Jealousy. Right? Oh, somebody else gets the better, you know, draw. Right? Anger. right? Fear of failure and fear of loss of esteem, right? Absolutely debilitates some kids, right? They can't take a standardized exam because you know what? You know, if you got a low grade on the standardized exam, you know what that would mean? You're a completely stupid idiot and you're worthless to society and you're certainly comparatively worthless, you know, with respect to the geniuses of this world. Do kids do this? Absolutely they do it. They're paranoid. They go into these exams and they're thinking it's self-definitional. It's very unhealthy, right? But jealousy, fear of failure, fear of loss of esteem, inferiority, superiority, right? I mean, these kids are devastated. They're depressed on the one hand, and they're elated on the next hand. They're lonely on the one hand. They belong to the winner group on the other hand. Hey, do the winners benefit any more than the losers? No, the winners do not benefit. The winners get to become narcissists. And you know how happy that makes people, right? You can't make a mistake in public. Spitzer, that word spectroscopy, you pronounced it spectroscopy 3 times. Now everyone believes you're a consummate idiot. And then you go home, because you believe them, right? So you go home and you play that tape 100 times in your mind and have suicidal feelings? Been there, done that. Yeah, it's absolutely possible. You can't be winner enough to win all the time. Oh, by the way, winners should never get onto a plateau where you can't go any further. Yiko, right? When you get up to the top of your game and there's still people going ahead of you and you hit the old plateau and the only thing that matters is, right, being better than achieving more, doing whatever, being more intelligent than all the rest of these guys out there. For all intents and purposes, you can go right into a depression. And then right from the depression into very self-destructive activities. And by the way, narcissists are very lonely people. Because narcissists really do hold a whole lot of people in contempt. And they like getting adulation from the people they hold in contempt. I know, been there, done that. Right? It's very simple to do. You know, you want to walk up to people and go, I know you're happy with your paltry existence. You've only accomplished X and Y and Z with your... But if you're happy, that's great. I'm content that I've done so much more than you. And now I'd like you to admire me for just disdaining and holding you in contempt. And then one day, you know what I mean? You have get some self-respect, so you get really ticked off. And you decide not to give me the adulation I so desperately prize. And then what happens? You get really ticked off at them. Who do you think you are not giving me my adulation today, you little inferior? You're going to have to pay. Been there, done that. And then you wonder, how come people are avoiding me in the hallway? Well, how come, you know, people are poised for flight at all times when I seem to come into the room? Yeah, contemptuous people don't have friends. They have some obsequious admirers, period. What's my point? My point is you can't win this game. Our kids can't win this game. There will never be enough for the winners, and the losers will feel as if their lives are worthless, and they're not. It's a complete falsity. You can see, A, how this causes suffering, and B, you can see how no one can understand suffering who can be caught up in the comparison game. Level 2 dominance. Very, very hard to see through to the benefits of suffering. Even elderly people will choose assisted suicide. They will. Because it doesn't make sense what's happening to them if they're losing comparative advantage. Enough said. What do we do? We have to give them techniques to get out of it. And we have three techniques. I'm just going to briefly describe them, and then we have to move on to our next thing. First technique, we need to get people started, especially our younger people started, on making their life's manifesto. They've got to take out a piece of paper, and they have to start just with one line even. You don't have to answer all these questions. I'm going to give them 10 questions. How can I make an optimal positive difference to my family? How can I make an optimal positive difference to my friends? Start with your most intimate relationship, move upward, right? More general. How can I make an optimal positive difference to my friends? How do I make an optimal positive difference to my school or to the organizations or the institutions that I touch? How do I make an optimal positive difference to my community? I don't know, maybe work on a little league team, maybe, you know, help with the construction of a Habitat for Humanity project, whatever. How do I make an optimal positive difference to my community? How do I make an optimal positive difference to the kingdom of God? How can I bring hope into people's lives? How can I share my faith with them? How can I give them a sense of their transcendent dignity and worth, their ultimate and eternal destiny? How can I do that? How can I make an optimal positive difference to my church? How can I make an optimal positive difference, if I'm so lucky, to the culture or to the community or to the organization with which I work or to the society, if I'm so lucky? But give them the questions and tell them, I know you're not going to be able to answer 5% of these puppies, but the ones you can answer, start jotting down some words. Because I'll tell you something right now. You start working on this list, in about a year to 2 years, you'll have a remarkable list. And right after that list is completed, put this down. For this I came. This is my reason for living. My reason for living is not to be more intelligent than you. 50% of you are more intelligent than me. This is of no consequence. My reason for living, right, now we're going up to level 3, is I want to use the intelligence I have to make the optimal positive difference that I can with my life. That's my purpose, not to be better than you. My purpose is not to be more competitive than you. My purpose is not to have more achievements. My purpose is simply to achieve what I can to make an optimal positive difference to my life. Written right out here on this whole list of my little manifesto. My purpose in life is not to have more status than you. It's just to use the status and credibility that I have to make an optimal positive difference with my life. That's what I'm here for. Notice then what has happened. Level 2 has stopped being an end in itself to be better than somebody. It now becomes a means to getting to a higher end, namely the contributive end of making a difference to the kingdom of God, to the community, to my family, to my friends, to my organizations, institutions, etc. That is a huge leap. When you make that leap of translating level 2 from an end to a means, I'm not kidding you. When you remember the jealousy, the fear of failure, the fear of loss of esteem, right? The ego rage, the self-pity, the suicidal thoughts over mispronouncing word. All those negative emotions start going down hugely. The narcissistic impulse starts going down hugely. And when that happens, people are so much nicer. I mean, they, instead of driving one another crazy with either narcissism on the winning end or inferiority and jealousy on the losing end, we actually start entering into empathy or relationship with others. So let me just finish this up real quick. We get to the whole idea of our second technique. And our second technique is to teach kids how to look at other people. Some of you, I've done weddings for two of you in this room, and you'll recognize this. But our obligation is to look for the good news in others. Our obligation is to look for the good news in others because love begins with looking for the good news. And empathy can only happen when we're looking for the good news. But here again is the problem. The bad news is our default drive. It's so much easier to recognize what's irritating, weak, stupid, and unkind. Add history to it. Lo, these many years. And when we do, when we let the bad news occupy our whole mental framework, if that's how we're looking at the person, so we see this wonderful human mystery, and all we see are irritating, weak, stupid, and unkind, lo, these many years, and that's what we're looking for, no empathy will happen. No empathy, no love. And what I mean by love is when doing the good for the other is just as easy, if not easier, than doing the good for myself. Can't do it. Impossible. Too self-involved, too much ego going on. And I count myself in the front of the line. I mean, it's tough to have an act of empathy, an act of real love, if you're looking for the bad news and the other. So we try and help the kids to move toward this discipline of looking for the little good things that people try to do and the great good things that they aspire to do, the strengths that they have that we don't have, right? Their faith, the mystery of their being, the fact that they're transcendental beings. I mean, they're deep sea fish. I mean, these people are living for perfect and unconditional truth, love, goodness, beauty, and being. They've got a soul. They're mysteries. They're incredible. And not only that, the gratuitous acts of kindness. Oh, make a list of those. Because, boy, I'll tell you, I've had so many people in my life who have been gratuitously kind to me when I've been a rat to them. You know, I've been impatient or something else. And then they turn right around and they're nice to me. And I just want to fall off my chair because the love that's manifest is so deep. You know, and delightful idiosyncrasies. Don't forget that. Because, of course, that's the whole foundation of buddydom. My point I'm trying to get to is if we can get the kids to focus on the good news and the other, empathy becomes a real possibility. And if it becomes a real possibility, we're helping them to love, to move beyond egocentricity and narcissism right to the heart of love. And if they do not have that capacity to look for the good news in the other, we relegate them to mere stoicism. You know what I mean? I mean, here comes Joe walking down the corridor. Here comes that irritating, stupid, unkind, and weak sot walking down the corridor. But I'm a good Christian, so I will love him anyway, because what does not kill me makes me stronger. Colonel Kink. The point I'm trying to get to is clear. There's no love in that. That is the mere duty of a stoic. And it would be horrible if Christianity were reduced to that. Enough said. The third thing is prayer, and I'm going to get to that later. We can get them up to level 4. We can get them to some effective forms of prayer. I'm going to call them spontaneous prayers, transformative prayers, teaching them how to follow the guidance and the inspiration of the Holy Spirit to not only live transcendentally, but to take the grace that comes from prayer and make it a part of their lives. And there's a discipline to that, and you kind of have to learn it and relearn it, but eventually it becomes habitual, and that prayer life becomes a virtue. Now, I think these three things of having a manifesto with my life's purpose, how am I going to make an optimal positive difference to family, friends, church, community, etc.? How am I going to look for the good news in the other? Keep my eyes focused on the good news in the other. And how am I going to carry out my little discipline of prayer, following the guidance and the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, having these spontaneous prayers to hand that'll help me, these little conduits of grace when I get into trouble, how I want to use the Eucharist and the sacraments to be transformative in my life and so forth. There's a discipline to it, but at the end of the day, we can help our kids to move out of what I call level 1, level 2 dominance into level 3, level 4. And that's going to help them on three levels. Number 1, the anxiety levels are going to go way down. Number 2, they're going to get to the point where they want to live for an optimally meaningful life, both in this world and in the transcendent world. And if they're living for optimal meaning and they're living for optimal good, they're living for optimal love, right? Optimal salvation. If that's what they're doing, believe me, they are going to do so much good for the world around them. I mean, they're going to be white tornadoes for the good. For all intents and purposes, what better gift can we give to our kids than to just make the light of the Lord and the light of virtue burn within them so strongly that they become change agents for peace and for goodness, right? They're trying to elevate people and elevate culture, and they use every skill, rhetorical skill or athletic skill, whatever it is at their disposal, to make a difference. That's worth it. And that'll help them to get through suffering. And that'll give them a remarkably meaningful life. Can we just do near-death experiences before the break, or did I just...
Yeah, we should probably do a break now.
A break, okay. I promise I'll speed up. I promise, I will. Okay, thank you.
There's food and drink over here on the other side.
Oops, got a little carried away there, but I'll catch up.
It's four. I didn't want to stop you.
Okay.
4:06, actually.
Well, I'm still going to
plow it.
I'm going to plow it. Sorry about that. Yeah, sorry. I'm going on four levels.
Hey, Ari.
Good to see you. Well, you got it twice in a row.
Yeah, totally, yeah.
Okay, so we have a 15-minute break, and the restrooms are down the hallway, and there's some refreshments over on the table for you.
Thank you, though, for offering. Hey, you've got a real nice voice.
Thank you. I think so, too.